This is Bill Newman, WHMP.
Good morning, good afternoon. Josh Silver in for Bill Newman on your chilly Friday here with the man of the day, Monty Belmonte. Hi, Monty.
Hey, Josh.
We have some great guests today, and I'm gonna save that. I'm gonna build the suspense, but before we get to them, blazing across the top of the fold of the Hampshire Gazette today, Monty, why don't you tell our listeners?
UMass fires football coach Molnar.
Big deal. I asked Monty when I came in, I was like, I kind of am into this, but yeah. Are you?
Yeah, I'm into it. We've been following it with Max Page on Your State U Wednesdays on the Newman Show about all the money that's been invested in the new UMass Minutemen football program and how economically sound that is as a decision as a university system and getting them into the new bowl subdivision. But after winning only two games in two seasons, a 2-22 record, decided to give him a just post-Christmas present on Boxing Day and send Molnar packing with $800,000 of severance pay.
Oh,
right
my
there.
Goodness.
Yeah.
$800,000.
Yeah.
Well, so that's a big deal for football fans. Of course, they moved into the big division. They've been playing at Gillette Stadium, had almost not enough people, just barely squeaked out enough people in the stands to keep them in that. But it's been ugly. In the meantime, though, things are really looking up for UMass hoops, although the men's basketball team is going to be facing Providence on December 28th at the Mullen Center, and all the inside tracks are that they are probably going to lose that.
Well, they've been ranked really well, and there's a lot of excitement surrounding UMass hoops. Much cheaper sport to do, a better like investment, if that's why you're doing athletics in the first place, rather than investing these millions and millions and millions of dollars into the new stadium and the football program for one win a year for 2 years. But we'll see. Some older coaches have expressed some interest in coming back, and we'll see where it goes with UMass.
A couple other quick things. The Forbes magazine listed the top 10 wealthiest people in the world. Big surprise, 7 of the 10 are from here in the United States. Shining a light on just the extent of the disparity of income distribution in the United States, along with increased numbers of reliable economic research that ties the consolidation of wealth into the hands of a few with the sort of economic stagnation and decline of the middle class. And something we will come back to in future shows. We have too many great guests today to stay with that for very long. One other headline that caught my eye, increased division between sort of mainstream GOP leaders like Boehner and McConnell, the heads of the House and the minority leader of the Senate, respectively, who are really at public odds with the Tea Party, which is only now at 22% favorability. And we're starting to see more and more visible fractures between those traditional Republicans and the insurgents. And one of the interesting dynamics behind this, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is one of the biggest spenders in American elections, really put a lot of money and energy behind many of the Tea Party insurgents over the last few years. But then when it came time to actually negotiate laws, the Chamber of Commerce saw Tea Party members then defying them. And so the dynamics have shifted. Another topic we will come back to. But first, I want to introduce our first guest this morning. Jonathan Haidt is a professor at the New York University. Previously, he was for many years at Virginia and has been a really leading voice and an amazing voice in terms of how do Americans think? How do people in this country self-identify? Why are we conservative or why are we liberal? Why do we disagree about things? Why don't we just get along? That's the non-academic intro to Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Josh. Thank you, Monty. Pleased to be here.
And happy holidays. Thanks for joining us on your break from your academics work. But I wanted to ask you, on your own website, you cite your interview with Bill Moyers, the legendary TV anchor, former senior advisor for the President Johnson mm-hmm. White House. And on your website, you said, the best video interview I've had, I think, was with Bill Moyers. And he asked you a question about your big breakout book that came out a few years ago called The Righteous Mind. Mm-hmm. And he sat down across from me and he said, John, why the righteous mind? I'm asking you the same question.
Okay. Well, I study morality, And there are books out there called The Moral Mind and things like that. But what I wanted to explain is why we are so moralistic, why we judge each other so much. And I didn't want to just say that that's a bad thing, that's a negative thing. In my research and trying to understand why we're so moralistic, I came to believe that this was one of our big secrets as a species, is that we developed this ability to judge each other and then to team up against each other and to form teams. And, you know, especially for people on the left, that sounds like, oh, you know, war, intergroup conflict, that sounds terrible. but compared to all other species that can't cooperate, no other species on Earth can really cooperate very much unless they're kin, unless they're like bees and ants. But we have this incredible ability to work together with people that aren't our relatives and fight for good, build countries, build companies, build sports teams. So I just wanted to show that this righteousness, this judgmentalism, is both an ugly part of our nature, but it's also this amazing thing that lets us cooperate.
Now, Jonathan, I'm going to share with you why I'm interested in your work and why I invited you onto the show. And I'm curious if some of the same motivations that drive that are ones that have pulled you into your field. And that is, for me, as a public interest advocate, I am most concerned with passing laws and policies that benefit the many. That's what I do. And what I found was I had two sets of aha moments. The first one was when I realized that for me, as a social liberal, while Democrats are more in agreement with me on things like, say, abortion or gay marriage, that when push comes to shove in Washington and in state capitals, I've found that Republicans were terrible on my issues and Democrats were really bad.
Yes,
in terms of what they actually do. And I realized I was just massively disappointed. And then I looked at those people who vote for those politicians. And what I found was, in talking to ordinary people who self-identify liberal and ordinary people who self-identify conservative, that beyond the social issues like gay marriage, that actually they agree on many more things than I realized. Was that a similar catharsis for you?
Well, yes. I mean, what you need to distinguish is between people who are engaged, you know, who are normal, moral people with moral reactions, and people who are caught up playing playing a game. And politics is a game with its own rules, its own logic. I haven't met many congressmen, but I gave a talk to some Democratic congressmen a year and a half ago. And as one of them put it, well, you know, this is all very nice, but, you know, we have to pass our exams every 2 years. These were members of the House of Representatives. So if they don't get reelected, that's it, they're out. And in Washington, the game is a duopoly. That is, there's just two, there are two parties, and it's mostly a zero-sum game. And so even though, yes, I agree with you, the Democrats are really bad on these issues, and the Republicans are substantially worse, but they're all locked into playing this game. They're not bad people. In my experience, people go to Washington because they want to fix problems. Sometimes it's ego, too, of course, but we have to really focus on the game that they play. And in order to, it's like Rollerball. If you for those of listeners that remember this, you know, movie Rollerball from the 80s, I think it was, it's like this life-or-death struggle where as long as you kill the other guys more than they kill you, you win. And so we got to change the game so that our representatives don't have to spend all their time basically whoring themselves for money to win elections.
We're talking to Jonathan Haidt, a professor at NYU, New York University. And the topic at hand is around the polarization of American politics and the American people. And it's so important because for all of us who care about every issue that is in gridlock and this constant frustration we face in trying to see something positive come out of Washington and out of state capitals, I would say that this kind of question that Jonathan wrestles with about how to find common ground between Americans without selling out and without kind of creating mediocre and tepid and ineffective outcomes, this is the great challenge of our day. But we're going to have to wait till after the commercial break to come back and find out why Jonathan says that that humans are born to be hypocrites. But we'll be back right after the break. I'm Josh Silver.
This is Bill Newman, WHMP.
Stephanie Miller.
The Mexican right-wing legislator that said
yes,
gay people not can marry because they do not have sex face-to-face.
Right. They don't look at each other.
Right. They don't make eye contact. Greg writes, Steph, so apparently if a straight sex participant is blind or has sex in the dark, it doesn't count? That's correct.
Good point.
Computer says, yeah.
Stephanie Miller, weekdays from 10 till noon, WHMP on FM at 96.9, WHMP.com.
One of the first things you notice about Fort Hill Auto Body on College Street in Amherst is how professional and clean the place looks. And from the minute you walk in the door, Fort Hill Auto Body will make the best of one of life's most unwanted situations. Fort Hill Auto Body can handle major collision repair, minor dings and blemishes, glass replacement. They can even detail your car. And if you need a replacement vehicle, there's a car rental option right next door. For friendly, professional, and honest auto repair, it's Fort Hill Auto Body, College Street in Amherst.
Is a bad credit score keeping you from getting the things you want? If you've been denied credit, paying high interest rates, or just concerned about your credit report, then call the experts at CreditRepair.com. At CreditRepair.com, our name says it all because it's all we do. With over 15 years of success helping people find solutions to their credit score problems, we know our strategic three-step credit repair process can help you. Call today for your free credit consultation and learn how to turn your credit score into the key that unlocks the door to the things you want, from a car to a house, even a new job. It only takes a few minutes, but what a difference it could make. When you call, you'll also get a free credit report and credit score. Join the thousands of men and women who trust CreditRepair.com as their credit repair partner and call 800-294-7296 for your free consultation. That's 800-294-7296. 800-294-7296.
My name is Silas Kopp. I'm a furniture designer and I work in East Hampton and rented space in the building owned by Riverside Industries. So I got to rub elbows with the people who are in the program, went away with a great appreciation for the work that they're doing for supporting people with developmental disabilities. I've become friends with lots of the people in the program over the years. I have employed some of the people. With many of the people, we go to a baseball game every year. It's clear to me that Riverside is offering people a reason to get up in the morning. There's a social life surrounding Riverside Industries. People are given a chance to work up to their abilities. People will share their paychecks with me, not the money, but the amount that they've earned in a week. And there's some great pride surrounding all of that. Maybe setting aside a little money so they can go to that baseball game. Any stigma that I might have attached to them has melted away over the years. People, regardless of those circumstances, are pretty much like I am. We're all very similar.
RSI.org.
This is Bill Newman, WHMP.
Josh Silver in for Bill Newman this week. On the phone with us, Jonathan Haidt, a professor in the Business and Society program at the New York University Stern School of Business, and a leading academic and visionary, if I may say so, on this notion of the right-left divide in American politics and culture and why it exists. When you were in that interview with Bill Moyers, John, you said, let's look at open eyes at real human nature and the fact that we as humans are born to be hypocrites. What does that mean?
Think about any animal. Why does it have the body that it has? Spiders are built to live on webs. They evolved to master webs. And dolphins in the water. And where do humans live? Well, we evolved to live on the savannah, sure, but more importantly, we evolved to live in a web of gossip. We are always talking about each other. We're always judging each other. And this is part of that ability that I mentioned before, this amazing ability we have to cooperate. Well, that only works if we're always vigilant against cheaters and liars. So we're always trying to figure out, we're very critical of others, but at the same time, we're doing everything we can to mount a public relations campaign for ourselves. And the two parts are almost unconnected. The hypercriticalness of others, well, actually, it's functionally connected to how we play offense against others. We play defense for ourselves. And this is why everybody else seems to be so hypocritical, other than you. You and me, we're fine. We're consistent. But gosh, it seems everybody else, don't they see what a hypocrite they are?
Yeah.
That's the world we evolved into. And it's the secret of our success as a species. It's why you are devoting your life to, presumably you could make a lot more money if you devoted yourself to making money, but you're fighting to clean up our government because you're mad as hell, I presume, as am I. So we've got all these moral motives, and to live in a world of, other people who are moralistic, you've got to mount a PR campaign for yourself.
So now, as Americans look to gridlock in Washington, we look at the government shutdown, we look at the way the two major parties are completely at odds. How do we make sense of that in the context of your analysis, and where do we go from here?
So I think the key thing is to look at this as a game in which real human beings are caught with tremendous pressures upon them, and that game is politics. And the most important thing, I think, is to reduce the two things. One is reduce the power of extremists and the role of money. If we could do those two things, we'd get back to just normal levels of corruption where, you know, congressmen do things that are good for their own constituents but bad for the country. That's like normal democracy. So what I mean is start by the most important thing, single thing we could do is everybody should pressure their state legislatures to have open primaries. Because at present what happens is almost all congressional seats are safe seats, so nobody's worried about the general election. They're all worried about getting primaried. They're all worried about a challenge, especially on the Republican side, from the far right, which is very organized right now with the Tea Party.
And so just so folks know, open primaries just simply means that when the primary vote happens, anybody can vote, even if it's for Republicans, for Democrats. Democrats can vote for Republicans, vice versa. Independents can vote. And it takes the walls off of what can often be very small turnout votes just by partisans.
Exactly. So where that's been tried in California and Iowa and other states, you get very quick moderation because extremists can't win by just getting, you know, the 3% of far-right Republicans who go to the polls, and same on the left too, but the extremists can't win by just getting a few percent to vote for them. They have to have broader appeal. That's the most important single thing we could do is open primaries. The gerrymandering turns out not to matter all that much. Gerrymandering is ridiculous and it's corruption, but that's not a major contributor to polarization, it turns out.
And just for folks who don't know, gerrymandering, that was just the way that political parties, you know, at the state level draw these absurd-looking boundaries for congressional districts in order to protect their members of Congress and prevent members of the other party being able to win.
That's right. So if you think about it, there are these two imperatives. Change the game so that there's two games going on in Washington. There's the vote game and the money game. So we can change the vote game so that congressmen have more of an incentive to do what's right and that will win as opposed to doing what appeals to the extremists. Second, on the money game, that's more complicated because the Supreme Court obviously ruled that there's a right to free speech for corporations, which makes it much more difficult. Still, there are some ideas floating out there. What's his name? Larry Lessig has a great TED talk. There are ideas about giving citizens vouchers and money to counteract. This is where Josh.
This is where I should pick up, right?
Yeah,
this is,
right.
Ideas like a public funding of elections where you can have citizens can have a voucher to put into politics, changing some of the laws, like making it so that politicians have to wait 5 years before they start lobbying after they've served in Congress, or limiting the amount of money that registered lobbyists can give to politicians, making all political money transparent and so that you can't hide it. And also another very popular one is simply banning members of Congress from soliciting and accepting money from entities they regulate. Imagine that.
Yeah, God, it's so obvious. Yeah. I mean, you know, there are laws against corruption everywhere except with Congress. I mean, guys get onto the banking committee so they can get huge donations from the banks to regulate those very banks. It's unbelievable that this is legal.
Yeah. Now, Jonathan, we're going to run out of time soon, but I want to finish with a thought that's a little bit more personal than political. In your interviews, you have said that liberals tend to misunderstand conservatives more than vice versa. And
right.
In this audience, we're talking to Western Massachusetts here, a generally a liberal crowd, a lot of frustration towards the other side, just like the conservatives in other parts of the country feel massive frustration towards liberals. Can you tell our audience sort of what can we do in our day-to-day lives that's constructive with some of the ideas that you've been pioneering?
Mm-hmm. Well, the most important thing is to cultivate a little bit of moral humility. I mean, that's what happened to me. I was never a humble guy. I was a very self-righteous guy. I was always a very angry liberal. I grew up under Ronald Reagan. I thought he was the devil. And when I set out to study political psychology, I committed myself to being like an anthropologist and trying to understand conservatives from the inside. I read a lot. I watched TV. I talked to the few conservatives I could find. There aren't really any in the academic world, as far as I know. And what I came to see is that they're not crazy. They have some values that liberals don't really share. But in general, the liberal moral palette is much more focused on really two moral foundations. There's sort of care and compassion is one, and sort of oppression, you know, fighting oppression and dominance is the other. And you know, if you look at Occupy Wall Street and the left tends to talk about care and compassion. The right, while they have that in their personal lives, they don't use that much in their political lives. Rather, they care, the social conservatives, care more about group loyalty, respect for authority, a sense of purity and sanctity. So the first thing is just to realize the other side isn't crazy. They have different values, and sometimes those values are actually quite good and helpful. And what I found empirically in my research is that liberals have more trouble pretending to be conservatives and taking surveys pretending they're conservatives, whereas conservatives can quite well pretend to be a liberal and accurately fill out a survey. That's what I mean when I say liberals have a harder time putting themselves in the shoes of conservatives than vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an empathy problem here. And actually, liberals are generally better at empathy than conservatives, so it ought to be possible to learn. That's part of what I was hoping to do with my book, The Righteous Mind. It was written mostly for people on the left, and originally I got into this to help the Democrats win because I was very upset the Democrats kept talking so naively about morality.
Does it fundamentally come down to just the view of the role of government between conservatives and liberals?
Oh, absolutely not. No.
You don't think so? Because it seems like they're, you know, the empathy and the reaching out to people who are in need, in a Democrat or a liberal's mind, would be something that the government should be involved in. The conservatives may hold many of those same principles to help the poor and feed the needy, but they just don't think the government should be involved in it.
That's the central specific issue we're debating as a country. But I think it's more profitable to look at what each side holds sacred. And what they hold sacred is very, very different. On the left, what they hold sacred is especially victims of oppression. So there was the shift to the new left in the 1960s, and baby boomers in particular take women's rights, civil rights, African-American victims. Those are what are most sacred. And those are the things that they will sacrifice anything else to protect or to advance. On the right, they will hold America sacred, or the Bible, or Jesus, or family authority. So I think you get much further by looking at what each side holds sacred. And if you know what a group holds sacred, you know where they are irrational, where they are immune to evidence, where you can't simply say, well, look, if we do this policy, we'll have better outcomes. The response to which will be, well, hell no, I'm not sacrificing my sacred values.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking to Jonathan Haidt. He's a professor in the Business and Society program at the New York University Stern School of Business. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Josh. Good luck to you in your noble crusade.
Thank you. I'm Josh Silver in for Bill Newman. We'll be right back.
Get in on the conversation. Call 413-586-7140. This is Bill Newman, WHMP.
Feel like breakfast for lunch? Or how about lunch for lunch? You can have breakfast or lunch for lunch at Sylvester's, 111 Pleasant Street, downtown Northampton. Open till 2:30. Sylvester'sRestaurant.com.
For WHMP News, I'm Chris Collins. News brought to you by Garmin. Don't hate traffic, avoid it. Get a Garmin newbie with subscription-free HD digital traffic and keep moving. Drive with Garmin, the most trusted name in GPS. UMass Amherst has fired its head football coach. Charlie Molnar only won two games during his two-year tenure with the university. He was let go Thursday. A Belchertown man seriously injured after being hit by a tractor trailer on I-290 in Worcester. The 45-year-old man was walking on the highway Thursday around 9. Witnesses told police the man stepped into traffic. It was not the trucker's fault. The man's name has not been released. A visiting former nurse is accused of stealing nearly $10,000 from an elderly East Hampton woman. Police say Tanya Reddick of Westfield improperly used her client's ATM card. The unusual account activity occurred between August and November and was noticed by the woman's son, who had access to his mother's online banking. And Greenfield's losing its town clerk. Maureen Winsick has announced she is stepping down from her post January 24th to move back to the private sector.
I've been here for 25 years as of next week, and, you know, I believe it's time to move on and do something else, and I am going to resume my career in real estate at Fitzgerald Real Estate.
Winsick has formally notified the town council of her plans. It is that body that appoints the town clerk. In sports, the Bruins take on the Ottawa Senators at the Garden tonight.
We're tracking sunshine for the end of the week. For today, mostly sunny, highs 34 to 38. For tonight, partly cloudy, overnight lows 16 to 20. For Saturday, sun and clouds and mild, highs in the lower 40s. I'm 22 News Storm Team Meteorologist Adam Stremko on 1412:40 AM and 96.9 FM, WHMP.
Your next check of news comes in a half hour. For Denise Vozella, I'm Chris Collins, WHMP News.
Have you been to any financial seminars lately? While you tackled your free prime rib dinner, did the presenters disturb you with information that was guaranteed to upset your digestion? By dessert, did they have all the answers? This is Gary Thomas of the Wealth Technology Group, and there is a huge gap between real financial advice and a sales pitch. Fact is, that free dinner just might cost you more than you could imagine. When you come to our office, you won't get a steak, just some fruit cookies and a beverage, but most importantly, you'll get sound, expert, and caring financial advice. Call us or visit our website, wealthtechnology.com, and come in for a complimentary, no-obligation visit.
Gary Thomas is an investment advisor representative with securities and investment advisory services offered through Transamerica Financial Advisors Incorporated, TFA. Member FINRA, SIPC, and registered investment advisor. Wealth Technology Group is not affiliated with TFA.
If you haven't been to the huge semi-annual clearance sale at Yankee Candle Village in South Deerfield, get yourself in gear, because deals like these won't last long. Now through January 20th, save up to 75% on select candles, home fragrance, and accessories while supplies last. That's right, save up to 75% on select items, but it's only while supplies last. So drop everything, unless it's breakable, and get moving to the semi-annual clearance sale, now through January 20th at Yankee Candle Village, I-91, Exit 24, South Deerfield, Mass.
Shop Save 30 and save 30% on the stuff you were going to buy anyway. And now, save 30% even faster with print on demand. Print and eat. Print and shop. Print and save 30% instantly with print on demand. Shop Save 30 at WHMP.com.
WHMP on FM at 96.9. WHMP.com.
This is Bill Newman, WHMP.
Josh Silver in for Bill Newman. Our next guest, very exciting, Michael Rollins, is a professor at the Department of Geosciences at the University of Massachusetts, an expert on climate. Michael, thanks for coming in.
Happy to be here, Josh.
You know, we were just talking on the break as Michael sat down. Well, what are we going to talk about? There's so much to talk about. Fortunately, I'm so pleased that in this country we have finally accepted the fact that the Earth is warming, thanks to a massive, now I deal with money and politics issues for a living, and the massive influence of money in the political system has really factored heavily in why this country took an extra decade to accept that that climate change is real. But that aside, we're not going to cut, that's a topic for another day. Michael, talk to us about the general state of climate change today. You mentioned off in the break that November was the warmest month, the warmest November globally in the history of the world that we know of, though it was a little colder here than in the rest of other parts of the globe. And of course, 2012 was the warmest year on record since record keeping began. Can you speak to the general trends?
Yeah, well, the general trends, climate scientists were most interested in looking at long-term changes. Typically 30 years or so is a minimum we want to look at to talk about climate. So weather events that happen over a period of a few days, a warm spell for a few weeks, even a warm month or two, that doesn't really make up a trend. So climate, we're looking at long-term patterns. If we look at long-term patterns of warming, and particularly we can start with looking at the global average temperatures, we see that temperatures are warming. It's getting hotter, and that's as a result of an imbalance in the radiative balance of the Earth atmosphere system between the sun and the Earth. So there's more greenhouse gases. Those greenhouse gases are warming the planet, and this warming, we haven't reached a balance yet, so we expect additional warming moving forward. So the climate system, we're seeing warming over, let's say, the past 30, 40, 100 years when we look at the data globally. But that doesn't say we can't have short-term periods where we have a very cold spell. So you mentioned November of this year. November, if we look at a map of the changes in temperature, the amount of warming we've seen, the let's say the anomaly it's called, how much warmer than average it was. We look at the globe, we see that that month was the warmest, we believe the warmest since record keeping began.
The warmest November or the warmest month?
Warmest November, because you couldn't have,
It's
you tend to have the warmest month ever in the summertime because the Northern Hemisphere summers.
But here's a key point though. The climate deniers, largely funded by the big energy companies to try to keep things, PR cool so that they can keep keep drilling and selling. They talk about how that actually warming has not continued at the pace that some say, and you call that a warming pause. What is that?
Well, folks refer to this warming pause over the last, let's say, if you look over the past 12, 15 years or so, if we fit a what's called a trend line, so we take the data and you fit a best fit line, you see that it's warming, but it hasn't been as steep in the past, let's say, 12 or 15 years.
Even with 2012, the warmest year ever.
Yes, it still hasn't been quite as steep as if you look over the past 30 years or so. And so we're trying to understand, well, why is that? And one of the things is, well, you can't really, if you look at short-term trends over only 12 or 15 years, those trends, that change is very sensitive to the start and end times you use. So if you start that trend in 1998, which was the warmest year as of then, warmest year on record because of a strong El Nino, if you start with that year, then it's almost like you see no trend. It's the line's flat. Mm-hmm. But if you start in 1997, the year before that, you see a strong trend. So one thing is you can't look at short-term periods of time like that because they're very sensitive to the start and end periods. Then with the physical mechanisms, well, why hasn't it been getting as warm as some of the climate models might suggest it should have? Well, one of the things is a lot of that heat is going into the ocean. So the Earth is largely mostly ocean, and a lot of the radiative imbalance, this extra long-wave radiation from the greenhouse gases, that is, much of it is going into the ocean. So we look at some data, and it's hard to get data for large expanses of the oceans, but there are some measurements, and it appears that a lot of that heat is going into the deep oceans and deeper down, and eventually that has to come out. Mm-hmm. There's also been some volcanic eruptions, small volcanic eruptions that have occurred that may have slightly dampened the warming.
I thought volcanoes were hot.
Well, volcanoes eject lots of stuff into the atmosphere, and particularly things
like... So it acts as like a shade then.
Sulfate aerosols and things like that. So little, tiny little particles of sulfates and aerosols block some of the sunlight. So if you have a couple volcanic eruptions in a few years, that can dim things, damp the warming. Also the solar cycle. There's an 11-year solar cycle from a maximum to a minimum. And the minimum of the solar cycle over the past 5 years or so, that minimum was sort of extended a bit longer than what is typical. So the sun has been in a relatively quiet phase in recent years. Now that doesn't really have
this how hot is the sun burning today?
Or the solar flares would add to the global climate change, temperature, right?
But the solar effect doesn't have as much of an effect. It's a very, very small.
You can tell Monty and I are serious experts on
this. Yeah, totally.
Flares do a lot.
Yeah, they do.
Right?
The sun is hot. Am I right?
Sun is pretty hot.
We're talking to Michael Rollins. He's with the Department of Geosciences at the University of Massachusetts. Michael, give us a quick snapshot because we're not going to have a ton of time. How, on a real world basis, Pioneer Valley, how is this climate change directly affecting us in terms of what we're seeing around us, you know, around the next 10 years? What are we seeing?
Well, so the recent trends and the changes we expect to see in the future, primarily it's warming is first. We're seeing it's getting warmer. There's more hot days, so you see more record warm days, more record set for warm days, and fewer record cold days. And that's one way we know that the climate is not stationary, that it's changing, because the number of record hot, record cold. If the climate was stationary, the number of record warm and the record cold would be the same over time. So warming is primarily, but we're also seeing an increase in extreme weather events, such as heavy precipitation events. So the number of days each year where you have, let's say, greater than 1 inch of precipitation. Mm-hmm. We're seeing an increase.
And we're seeing more of that here.
More of that here in the valley, yes, over recent decades. And we expect that to continue.
Yeah.
Along with the warming, we're seeing a lengthening of the growing season. Spring thaw is coming earlier. A few years back, there was a very, very warm late winter, early spring. Daffodils bloomed in many gardens 3 weeks earlier than usual. So we're seeing a lengthening of the growing season, increase in extreme weather events, heavy rain events, heat events. And then along with that, because we're seeing this melting of ice and land ice, Greenland and other places with land ice, we're seeing sea levels come up. So folks along the coastal areas, Boston, along the East Coast, are seeing sea levels come up as a result of the warming climate. And that's expected to continue.
Now, one thing I hear from the climate change deniers, and mostly conservatives, but perhaps there's some science behind it as well, is that how can global warming be happening when this year there is more sea ice than in years past? Is that true?
Well, there's more ice around Antarctica.
So not Arctic sea ice. That Greenland is all melting, but the Antarctic sea ice is increasing.
Well, be careful. We need to distinguish between sea ice, which is ice that's floating on the water in the Arctic Ocean, and Greenland is land ice. So one interesting thing to point out is the melting of Greenland, land-based ice, that ice goes into the ocean, and then it melts, and it raises sea levels. Melting of Arctic sea ice does not raise sea levels because that's like ice melting in your glass. It's already displacing water.
Right.
You mentioned the increasing ice extent around Antarctica. That's been something that's been happening. We're seeing almost a record amount or a higher than average amount of ice around Antarctica, and we think that's a result of warming causing the changes in the wind pattern around Antarctica and other factors, physical factors. So we believe we understand what's going on there. Eventually, you'll lose some of that ice as well, but the true signal you see is that Arctic sea ice, and that's shown a very sharp trend downward in the past 30 years, which is what we expect to see in a warming
world. So Arctic land ice, Greenland, and Arctic sea ice in the Arctic circle in the oceans is melting.
Yeah.
And that is causing it to make more ice somehow in the Antarctic.
The Antarctic sea ice increases are just a result of processes in the atmosphere and the ocean around there, and that's not reflecting the warming. The northern areas are what we see the warming greatest, melting of the Greenland. Greenland has had record melt years in recent years, and also the loss of the sea ice in the Arctic Ocean are a very sharp trend. Yeah.
Michael Rollins, are we doomed?
No, we're not doomed. There is hope. We believe that if we can reduce these greenhouse gases, if there's enough political will and enough desire to curtail our use of these fossil fuels, we're taking the carbon out of the ground, burning it, carbon's going into the atmosphere. If we can somehow limit the warming to under, let's say, 2 degrees Celsius, which is the point at which we feel that the most undesirable.
We're already
effects,
at 1 degree, right?
We're at 1 degree now. Most of the climate models suggest that on the current trajectory of greenhouse gas emissions, as they're going up, we're not seeing any reduction, any desire to reduce or any will. The projections for this area are by mid-century anywhere from about maybe 3 degrees Fahrenheit to as much as 6 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit warming by mid-century here. Wow.
So higher here than in other parts of the world?
No, there's a strong spatial pattern. Actually, more warming is as you go further north into the Arctic because you're losing ice and snow, which has very reflect light, so the ice albedo feedback. So in this area, we're about in the middle range here in this area.
Now, one of the big leaders of this issue is Bill McKibben, and he runs an organization called 350.org, and they have really planted their flag around this idea that the Keystone XL pipeline, which is designed to be built to carry oil from the tar sands in central Canada all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico to process and ship out. He says this is a defining issue, pulling up all of this, what they call very dirty energy out of central Canada. Is that indeed a bellwether case in terms of the amount of carbon that would be created through that process?
Yeah, well, Bill McKibben does have some very, very interesting opinions, strong opinions of this. There's a lot of carbon there. There's a lot of...
We don't like interesting. What does that mean? Interesting opinions.
I mean, I have to now put on my opinion hat, my personal opinion here, this separated from the science.
We like that.
So my personal opinion is there is a lot of carbon there. There's a lot of potential warming. If you were to take all that and start burning all that oil, tar sands oil, that could be you know, really, really make it difficult to start reducing these greenhouse gas emissions and concentrations. I know there's a lot of jobs at stake, and it's a lot of it's a very hot political topic. And all I could say is that there's just a lot of it up there, my understanding, and you know, burning all that tar sands oil would certainly contribute much more to a rising greenhouse gas concentrations.
We've been talking to Michael Rollins from the University of Massachusetts, a climate expert and a resident of the Pioneer Valley, yet another amazing expert that lives in our midst. Thanks for coming in, Michael.
My pleasure, Josh.
I'm Josh Silver in for Bill Newman. We'll be right back.
This is Bill Newman, WHMP.
From Northampton to East Hampton, from Holyoke to Springfield.
The community feels very strongly that they need to keep this hospital open. They feel very threatened by Bay State to suppress the nurses.
Anytime there's a strike, you get a commitment from a larger number to cross on the day of the strike gets there.
They mean business. They have been negotiating for a couple of years.
What we've got to make sure is that we've got enough nurses to be able to meet the patient needs of that day.
Local news every 30 minutes. WHMP. News, information, and the arts.
Every year when the whole family gets together, I'm reminded of how everyone's drinking tastes are so different, which is why I'm so happy I have State Street and Cooper's Corner nearby. Mom loves her Viognier, and Uncle Charlie likes a good dark stout, and my brother, his tastes are always changing. I go to State Street, and all I need to do is describe my relatives, and I get some great recommendations. And when it's time to celebrate, everyone's happy. And I never pay a ton because the staff at State Street are so good at pointing out specials and less expensive options. And I can even grab my last-minute groceries while I'm there. State Street's wine, beer, and spirits, that's how I help spread the cheer in my family every year.
Cooper's Corner in Florence and State Street in downtown Northampton. The sister stores that will help keep your family cheerful this holiday season. Cooper's Corner and State Street.
Did you know that a child with an intellectual disability is three times more likely to be bullied? For years, my friend Chris dreamed of being an athlete. Instead, he had to endure the constant ridicule of his so-called friends and classmates. Then he found Special Olympics. He joined a team, put on a uniform, and for the first time in his life, he belonged. He is now in his mid-30s and competes year-round in Special Olympics. It's changed his life. Sports are at the core of Special Olympics, but we are more than just a game. Through numerous health and education initiatives, Special Olympics has increased the life expectancy of people with intellectual disabilities around the world. Help us give a lift to countless more by donating your unwanted vehicle today. No annoying jingles, no fancy play on words, just one simple suggestion. Please call 800-590-1600 or find us on the web at recycleforgold.org. That old car may represent the past to you, but it's the future to a Special Olympics athlete.
We basically only ask people, what town are you from, when they walk through the doors, and the center is open to them. We provide food every day through the food pantry or hot lunch. We provide clothing through our free store, healthcare through our free health clinics, and we also provide community, not only as a place for people to come and access those services, but every service is provided through volunteers so that our model for service delivery is also achieving our mission. My name is Mindy Dom. I'm the executive director of the Amherst Survival Center.
This is Bill Newman, WHMP.
Josh Silver in for Bill Newman, and a very special day indeed. It's Inside Out. We've got Betsy Stone and Scott Cohen to talk about arts and sports, respectively. Betsy, what's going on in the world of arts?
Well, I was poking around downtown yesterday, and I popped into Michelson's Gallery on Main Street in Northampton, 132 Main Street, to see this exhibit I'd been wanting to look at called Icons, I as in eyeball, cons, by Nancy Hill. She did the funniest thing, painted single eyes about 4 inches in diameter in a little round canvas of famous people and paired them up. And there's one series, one quartet, that's the Beatles. the eyeballs of the Beatles. Very recognizable.
You could recognize the Beatles' eyes right away?
Yes.
It's like just the
just
eye.
The
right?
eye.
Really super.
Yeah, and painted very finely.
I want to hold your hand.
Oh, yeah, here. This is what it looks like. Oh, yeah, too bad you in the radio land can't see.
We're seeing the eyebrow and the
And you can see the top of the hair just above the eyebrow because they're young and they're not balding like us.
Right. Well, there's a later one of John Lennon paired with Yoko. Actually, so that's a slightly different picture of
Yoko
John Lennon.
Oho.
Yeah, right.
That's Spanish.
Then my favorite one was Salvador Dali and Frida Kahlo. But there was also Marilyn Monroe and Gandhi paired for some odd reason. I'm not sure why, but
they're so similar. Now that's Michelson's gallery.
Yes, and it's up through January 15th. It's been held over by popular demand.
That's great. What else?
But just to say, Nancy Hill is usually known for her eclectic still lives of cultural kitsch.
Do they have Paul Newman's?
No.
Yeah, that would be a good eye to do.
Paul Newman. I don't think so.
Or Frank Sinatra.
Why do you always ask about Paul Newman, Scott? I don't
know. Those famous eyes.
Yeah, very bold blue eyes.
Those bold blue eyes. Beautiful eyes. Well, there's something going on in the art world, at least in Northampton, that has to do with pop culture, because down at Unite Footwear on...
Crafts Avenue.
Is the work of an artist named Ryan Leary. He's an East Hampton artist and local guy, and he has painted his wrestling heroes, his World Wrestling Foundation, Federation heroes.
I think I did that in middle school.
Raw is Leary, and they're chalk and charcoal portraits. So you can go check that out if you want to see what other Paul.
Was Rowdy Roddy Piper there? It was my favorite.
You know,
he wore the kilt.
I just know Mr. T.
The kilt doesn't translate well in black and white, Monty.
That's true.
Interesting. That's eclectic.
Yeah, that is eclectic. So that's what I have for now.
Eyes and wrestling.
I could tell you more. I mean, if you're rattling around the house with your kids, Monty, Josh, and you haven't been to the Eric Carle yet. Mo Willems has an exhibit. It's been up for a while and is up through January 15th. I love his
books. What does that mean? What kind of stuff is it?
Children's book illustrator and writer.
Northampton resident, probably in Paris.
From around here, but he has very, really great wit in his books. I mean, just the kind of books you want to read to your kids. Right?
Also at the Carle right now, Barbara McClintock, who does these beautiful watercolors, teamed up with Natalie Merchant, the singer-songwriter from 10,000 Maniacs fame. She set all of these very famous poems to music. You hear the music in the gallery. You see these Barbara McClintock watercolors. That's worth checking out as well.
Borrow some kids and go over there.
Yeah.
And now we pivot to sports. Scott, what is going on? Why this kind of came? I have to admit, this came out of the blue for me. I've been following UMass football, and were you as surprised as we were?
Well, I was only surprised because Charlie Molnar, the head coach at UMass, was fired officially yesterday. And certainly his record, you were kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. But the athletic director said as early as a couple of weeks ago that they were not going to fire him despite 2-1-11 seasons. And then I guess all of a sudden they got some new information about what the players thought about him, and they had asked a lot of questions. There was that very controversial video with his practice techniques. They were boxing and wrestling, and some players were hurt. And I guess it was just an unmitigated disaster from beginning to end. And they finally decided to get rid of him.
Well, there was sort of an opaque line in the Gazette today, where the athletic director did say that this is not new. That this decision to fire him actually has been brewing for a while. Do you think
to wait until after Christmas?
Yeah.
Happy Boxing Day, Charlie Molnar. We waited a whole day.
So we ultimately don't really know if this was cooking for the last month or two, or if this actually did sort of escalate.
Well, I know he wasn't. As all coaches do, he started off with great fanfare and great hopes. You know, they make this new move to a different division and new locale. They're down at Gillette Stadium. And then all of a sudden things start going south on the field, and then you find out he lost the support of the alumni. I guess he wasn't they weren't very supportive of him. So the ball started rolling, and he finished at 1-11 again, and it was just lights out.
And can you just for the benefit of the many people listening who really don't follow this stuff, why does this matter? Why would UMass make this move into this new division? Invest millions of dollars. What is the end play here? No pun intended.
Hail Mary, I think.
Yeah, well, Monty and I were talking about it today. Most big-time, even big-time college football that we see on the networks, those programs lose money. They lose money in their own little self-contained corporations. But those football teams and the success and the television exposure, that draws students from all over the world to want to go to, say, a Penn State or a Texas. So while the program loses money, the program draws students and you know, increases donations and things like that. So they lose money on the one hand, but they're just PR machines to try and put the school on the map. And that's what UMass was hoping to do, to raise its national you know, recognition and things like that.
So it's a loss leader, like in retail.
It's a loss leader.
They sell something that they lose money on to get people in the store. UMass hoops. Now, I'm
now here's the here. Now you mentioned the basketball program. They have a nationally ranked basketball program, and they have a hockey team that plays in the best college hockey conference in the country.
Which you can hear right here on WHMP.
Which you can hear right here on WHMP, but yet they chose to invest millions in a loss leader football program. Never really made any sense to me. And back to Charlie Molnar, just the wrong guy at the wrong time, and they have to pay him close to $400,000 just to go away, and then they've got to hire somebody for a lot of money to come in and try and salvage this mess that they have.
All I know is if you watch the television show Friday Night Lights, they would never have let Coach Eric Taylor stick around for two years with one loss, one win in each year.
Very few would.
No, but that show's not real, Monty.
It's real in my heart. Clear eyes, full heart, can't lose.
All right, hey, one more little sports note to send us into the weekend. Paul Blair died yesterday. Paul Blair played center field for the Baltimore Orioles in the 1960s. He won two World Series with the Orioles and two with the Yankees. He was the quintessential center fielder. And baseball is the reason that we like it is because it takes us from our childhood into our adulthood. And for a lot of guys like me who are in our 50s, when we were growing up, Paul Blair was the best center fielder in baseball, and we remember these names, and there's been a lot of chatter about it on Facebook, you know, with guys my age. They said that the earth is covered three-quarters by water, and the other quarter was covered by Paul Blair. That's what a great baseball player he was.
Wow, that's profound, but we do have another minute, so before we go, UMass was 10-0 basketball, amazing team, ranked 22nd in the country. Played North Carolina last week, Florida State. See, I'm not a sports guy. But lost by 5 points at the end of the game. They were neck and neck the whole way.
Right.
Now, remember, Florida State was not ranked. They had been previously ranked earlier in the season, but they got knocked out. And a lot of people are saying that UMass hoops, you only have 30 seconds, have been playing above their ability, and now they're going to play Providence on December 28th, and they're going to get whooped, and they're not as good a team as they've seemed. What do you say to that?
Well, I say that one game, you know, does not make a season. You go on the road and you lose to Florida State in Florida. Nothing to be ashamed of there. And they're going to squash Providence like a grape tomorrow night.
Wow.
You heard it here first.
Scott Cohen, Betsy Stone, Monty Belmonte, Mark Berman in the background, our guest today, Jonathan Haidt, Michael from UMass. We've had a great show. I'm Josh Silver in for Bill Newman. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.